Klementinovsky v. Gonzalez. Mr. Hurst or Ms. Hurst?
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. Morgan Hurst for the petitioner, Dmitry Klementinovsky, who I'll refer to as Dmitry for my own sake. Dmitry asks this Court reverse the BIA's holding, finding him ineligible for a waiver under INA Section 212H. Dmitry applied for such a waiver due to the hardship his departure from the United States would cause his U.S. citizen parents, for whom he is the sole caregiver. Under the BIA's logic, in order to become eligible for such a waiver, Dmitry was actually first required to depart from his parents, leave the United States to some destination unknown, and then return to the United States. The BIA's illogical decision should be reversed for three reasons. First, the BIA's sua sponte decision that Dmitry was disqualified for a waiver based on the fact that he was convicted of an aggravated felony was an error as a matter of law. Dmitry's convictions all resulted in no jail time being sentenced and therefore took him out of the statutory language for aggravated felonies. The BIA issued its opinion without
that issue, do we, unless we knock down this distinction between admission and expulsion, isn't that true?
Your Honor, I think you can handle them either way. I suppose the government's response to that would be if you found him ineligible as convicted of aggravated felonies, you wouldn't get to the equal protection issues. So certainly in this case, there's no question he was not convicted of aggravated felonies. It wasn't an issue that was raised before the IJ. All that was in the record were the certified records of conviction, all showing no jail time. The government never argued that he was convicted of aggravated felonies until before this court. And the BIA simply decided on its own that he had been convicted of aggravated felonies, and the BIA was incorrect on that, consistent with the statutory language.
Do we reach that if we reject your equal protection argument?
If you reject our equal protection argument, Your Honor, then the aggravated felony issue, well, if you reject our equal protection argument or you reject that the statute should apply to him, then, yeah, the aggravated felony issue is not critical.
Without any language in the statute to guide us, isn't there some logic to the government's argument that an alien like Dmitry, who's going through a deportation proceeding, should be ineligible for a waiver available to an alien going through an exclusion proceeding?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that's the division the government's making here. Many courts would actually support what you just said, which is there is a difference between someone going through exclusion proceedings and deportation proceedings. But what the BIA and the government found is you can classify between two sets of deportable aliens, those like Dmitry, who did not leave the United States after their deportable convictions, and those who just happened to take a trip from the United States, return to the United States, and still exist as deportable aliens. That's the classification here that we are challenging. It's the classification that was rejected in a 212H setting by the 11th Circuit in Young. It's a classification that's been rejected by multiple circuit courts in the analogous setting of former 212C.
Oh, but why isn't the argument the same, that it gives the Immigration Service an extra bite at the apple? Because if he comes back, you know, he needs a visa and he's subject to inspection, the port of entry and so on, so they'd prefer these people to leave and come back.
And, Your Honor, that, of course, is part of the basis for treating excludable and deportable aliens differently. But the courts have been uniform in stating that you can't classify. You can divide between excludable and deportable aliens. Once you've made that division, though, you can't subdivide for something that has no rational basis. And the courts have been uniform on the issue of whether or not travel history of a deportable alien is a rational basis to uphold such disparate treatment. And they uniformly have said that it is not. This court has recognized on two different occasions the fact that classifying between deportable aliens in such a situation is improper. In 1995, the court in Young in the 11th Circuit is the only circuit court to actually have looked at this matter in a 212H environment. And in that case, the court found that there was no rational basis between dividing between individuals like Dmitry. and individuals who had happened to travel and return to the country and were still deportable. The government did not even discuss the Young case in its briefing. Your Honors, furthermore, the 212C case law under former 212C is also important here. 212C has been found to be an analogous statute to 212H. And for over 30 years, the courts have interpreted 212C as requiring...
I'm not sure how you responded to this question. So what the government says is that given that DHS inspects everyone who arrives, an alien who never leaves and remains in the United States may continue to fly under the radar, right?
Sure, Your Honor, but a deportable alien who has left the country and returned likewise can continue to fly under the radar. Once he's back in the United States, he is still needs to be deported.
But as he comes back in and is, you know, examined when he enters with his visa and so on, if there's something, you know, DHS has in its records against him, they can intercept him before he disappears into the vast population.
And, Your Honor, if they did intercept him, he would then be placed in exclusion proceedings, at which point the courts have found uniformly that there's a rational basis between dividing between those in exclusion and those in deportation proceedings. But once he is back, he's now a deportable alien again. And, again, the courts have been uniform that once you fall back into the deportable alien classification, there's no rational basis between dividing between two deportable aliens simply on the basis of a travel history.
I don't understand. I don't understand that. Because he mightn't have been back. He might have been stopped at the border coming in if he'd taken a trip. So we're in effect encouraging people to leave the United States and come back in and go through the admission procedure by giving them this this privilege, voluntary departure, or whatever it is, waiver of departure.
Well, Your Honor, again, the courts...
It's tenuous, but it's something, isn't it?
I don't think so, Your Honor. The courts have uniformly agreed that this is not... it's not something. The courts have said that, again, classification is allowed. You can classify between excludable and deportable aliens. But once you do that, you have to treat them the same way, and you can't use travel history as a basis for dividing between two sets of deportable aliens. And the Francis Court in the Second Circuit...
There is a rational difference, which is that the deportable alien who leaves and comes back may be caught coming in, whereas the one who never leaves is less likely to be caught.
Certainly there is the opportunity to catch, but again, the courts have found that is not enough.
See, why is that an irrational distinction?
It's an irrational distinction, Your Honor. Because
apparently there are millions of illegal immigrants in the United States. Now, obviously, very few of them are actually caught and deported. So, it might, by the other hand, we keep a huge number of people out when they try to come in. So, presumably, if we can somehow encourage illegal aliens to leave and come back, we will exclude more of them. That's the theory. It's tenuous, obviously, but a rational review, how can it be called irrational?
Well, I agree with Your Honor that it's beyond tenuous, but it can be called irrational, number one, because...
Quite beyond tenuous, because it is true that the DHS would like to have a second bite at the apple because it has such a poor record of catching illegal aliens in the United States. So, I mean, we'd love it. I mean, this is absurd, obviously. We'd love it if all 12, however many million there are, left. They all came back, right? They all lined up, come back. Then that would be bliss for the immigration authorities.
Well, Your Honor, my best answer to that is this issue has come up multiple times on the rational basis test on why isn't an irrational basis for a deportable alien who has traveled and returned to be treated differently. And not a single circuit court has found a rational basis exists there. The Seventh
have
Circuit...
Have they discussed this argument?
Your Honor, I think they have. Going back as far as the Second Circuit back in the Francis decision, that court simply found that when you are looking at an alien who has returned, he is now in a class called deportable. That is how the government has set up the system, deportable versus excludable. And once you are back in that class called deportable, there is no basis for...
No, we just said there is a basis. You just said it was tenuous. So how do the courts explain why it's so tenuous that it becomes irrational?
Again, I think the courts have explained that once you are back in the country...
I don't understand. That's not an explanation.
Well, you're right.
What do they say about this particular this argument? That's to advantage of the immigration authorities if they can induce deportable people to leave.
Well, and I think one thing, Your Honor, is that once again, once you're back in the country, all of the things that the government has to do to...
The question is, if you leave, you may not come, you may not get back in because you're going to have to go through the border again.
Of course, and those who don't get back are placed in exclusion proceedings and treated differently. Those who do get back, once again...
We want to create an incentive for these people to leave and come back so we have an extra way of intercepting them. So my question is, what do the courts say about this argument? Is this ridiculous? Can't happen? Or have they just not noticed it?
I think the courts have noticed the argument, Your Honor.
What have they said about it?
I think they've rejected it.
Well, why did they reject it?
Well, again, I think they see there being a difference between somebody who is stopped.
You're just repeating yourself. Why do they reject the argument that it is in the interest of the immigration authorities to get a second bite at the apple? What do they say about that?
Well, I think the bite at the apple they wanted was at the border, the exclusion level.
You're not answering the question. What do they say about the immigration authorities' interest in having this second bite?
Try to answer the question as much as I can here. They have not talked about the second bite, so
right,
to speak.
They have. So there's no authority, right? Because they haven't confronted an argument which, according to the government, establishes that there really is a rational basis.
Well, I disagree that they haven't looked at the issue. I mean, the issue is certainly prevalent any time you are distinguishing between a deportable alien who has traveled and a deportable alien who hasn't. I mean, the issue is live, even if it's not fully dealt with.
The question is whether the courts say, yeah, the government says they need the second bite, and we don't think so. They haven't supported it or something like that. I'm just curious what they've said about that, if anything.
Well, Your Honor, as to the second bite, there is no authority that says that. But they've rejected whenever the government has attempted to distinguish between these two groups of deportable aliens.
Okay, well thank you very much, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Zabla?
May it please the Court, my name is Anna Zabla, and I represent the United States Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez. Now, this case is about a man, a criminal alien, who wants relief from removal when neither statute, nor judicial precedent, nor administrative decision, nor constitutional mandate affords such relief to him. To expound, Congress has long established a dichotomy between inadmissible and deportable aliens, while the proceedings by which these aliens are ejected from the country are now uniformly called removal proceedings, the grounds for which such aliens are put into proceedings remain separate and distinct. Here, Mr. Komentanovsky was found removable on grounds of criminal deportability. He is, however, seeking relief available to waive only grounds of inadmissibility. As such, he's ineligible. Further, Mr. Komentanovsky was also found independently ineligible as an aggravated felon. So
that's very weak.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Well, your alternative ground about the aggravated felon is very weak because there's no indication, is there, that he was actually punishable by a year or more sentence?
Well, Your Honor, with all due respect, the government's position is that question is not reviewable because
I understand, but you offered it as an alternative ground.
Well, because the BIA found him...
If it's an alternative ground, then you have to be able to... I mean, you can abandon it, obviously, but you don't need it, maybe. But if you want it, wouldn't you have to show that these offenses he committed were punishable by a year in prison?
Actually, Your Honor, the burden falls on the petitioner. When a petitioner has been convicted of a crime that otherwise qualifies as an aggravated felony, and it appears that his eligibility for the relief requested may be in question, the burden falls on him to prove that he is not ineligible for that relief. In this case, Mr. Komentinovsky did not meet this burden, and as such, was the BIA sua sponte, concededly, found him ineligible. And regardless of whether the other question is met, he is ineligible as charged.
So at the hearing, there was no these various convictions where he received a year probation, a month court supervision, probation, and probation, that was not part of the record before the IJ?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Those convictions. You're saying it's his burden, but what's confusing about these sentences? How would one think that he was sentenced to something more than a year when you look at what these sentences are?
Your Honor, the convictions were in the record, but again, the government stance is that this question is not reviewable. There's no
convictions were in the record and the sentences, correct?
One of them, if I recall correctly, does not have the sentence specified. But again, this is not a reviewable question. It's a question of fact. There are two independent jurisdictional limitations, one under 1182H, which precludes the review of decisions regarding a grant or denial of that waiver, and another under 1252A2C, which precludes the review of questions regarding the removability of criminals found removable on the of aliens found removable on the basis of criminality.
So how do you get around our Lara Ruse case, a Seventh Circuit case, where we've held that we retain jurisdiction to determine whether an alien's criminal conviction is in fact an aggravated felony?
Well, we get around that because in those cases where this court has looked has taken that approach, the legal question involved the challenge to the crime itself. So, for example, if there were any question that, say, Mr. Komentinovsky's conviction for robbery and intimidation was in its nature a crime that threatened physical violence, if the definition of the crime
isn't
left...
Is there a question whether he was punishable for at least a year under any of these? Mm-hmm.
Well,
that's a legal question, mm-hmm. isn't it?
That's uncontested here. He was punishable by at least 1 year. The distinction that Mr. Komentinovsky is trying to make is whether he was actually sentenced to a year or not, which is a question of fact.
So that you regard as a question of fact? Isn't it sort of a question of judicial notice or something?
Right.
What his sentence is? Isn't that a public record?
Right. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. At the hearing, wasn't it introduced that he received a year probation, a month of court supervision, probation, and probation?
Your Honor,
I don't get this distinction you're trying to make. The sentences were in the record, weren't they?
Well, as I recall, the record omitted one, and I may be wrong on this one because I didn't see this actually as the crucial point here. So, if I'm going to move on, three points are crucial to the agency's case. First, the agency did not err in finding Mr. Komentinovsky ineligible for a waiver. Second, the Attorney General's interpretation...
Why don't you talk about this classification? You support the classification by arguing that it encourages aliens like Dimitri, who never depart, to self-deport and return to the United States at the border to undergo inspection. But what about the group of deportable aliens who have been able to re-enter the country without detection?
Well, because they could have been apprehended and put into the removal position, the Attorney General takes the position that the failure to put them in removal proceedings as inadmissible should not preclude them from benefiting from that waiver. In fact, this rationale, this carrot that's extended, has been looked at before once by this court in Laguerre v. Reno, and the court determined that encouraging voluntary departure of illegal aliens was a rational and sensible reason. Now, in that, for Congress's more lenient treatment of excludable as distinct from deportable aliens. Now, concededly, in this case, we're dealing with two different deportable aliens, but that doesn't take away the rationale of the reason for the classification.
Well, as the board's interpretation of 212H currently stands, aliens who unlawfully re-enter are eligible for a waiver of inadmissibility while aliens like Dimitri are not. How does this distinction serve a legitimate purpose?
Because the agency had one clear shot to apprehend these aliens and put them into proceedings. This is actually This is actually something that Congress seems to like. Right now, a bill is being debated that contemplates doing the very same thing, asking aliens to leave voluntarily, present themselves for admission, and upon doing so, being eligible for certain immigration benefits.
Well, of course, we can't really look at that right now because that's just in a bill. And then you also argued that the classification serves the purpose of conserving the government's resources, but wouldn't the government expend a comparable amount of time and effort locating and arresting a deportable alien who's reentered the country undetected?
Well, I believe that was a confusion. In the reply brief, the petitioner addressed that argument as a conservation argument. I do believe that the government was talking, when it was talking about conserving resources, it was talking, we were talking about the application for adjustment of status. Because otherwise, you would have to take this person who is being held deportable, but who is asking for to be admitted under an application for adjustment of status. You'd have to put him in deportability, get him out of the country, and then put him back into proceedings to apply. And so in that case, you are conserving resources. That just seems to be like a gap, like a misreading of the government's brief. So to address the court's earlier question, the courts in Francis and in Young did not address this rationale. In fact, there seems to have been a burden switching where, because the burden here is for the government needs to do nothing. It is for the petitioner to show that there is no conceivable, facially legitimate, or bona fide reason that would uphold the suspect classification. Here, the government has gone further. We have submitted the facially legitimate and bona fide reason, which is encouraging self-deportation so as to provide the government with one clear shot. Neither Francis nor Young addressed this rationale. Moreover, it should be noted that these cases were decided in a different statutory environment and prior to two congressional acts which have significantly curtailed the availability of this relief to criminal aliens, of 212C relief, sorry, the relief that was at issue in those cases. As to the legal aspect of the Attorney General's interpretation, the statutory language is clear. 1182H functions to waive certain grounds of inadmissibility enumerated in 1182A, which deems certain aliens ineligible to admit it into the United States. As such, the waiver is available only in exclusion proceedings and in circumstances analogous to exclusion proceedings. So, for example, a deportable alien that has an application for adjustment of status stands to benefit from such a waiver. Similarly, an alien found deportable as inadmissible at the time of entry also stands to benefit from such a waiver. Conversely, even if Mr. Klinitz-Donofsky were allowed to apply, he couldn't waive the grounds of deportability, the two-plus moral turpitude convictions. He would remain removable as charged. So in other words, even if he got what he wanted, there's nothing to waive under 1182A. I see that my time is up, so may I conclude, Your Honors?
Okay.
So essentially, we don't have a constitutional error or a legal error, and we have a clear statute, precedent, and administrative decisions. So the government respectfully submits the case and requests that the petition be denied.
Thank you, Ms. Sabla. Mr. Hirst, how much time does he have? No time, but we'll give you a minute anyway.
Your Honor, one thing I wanted to respond to was that the government's argument that the statute disqualifies Dimitri by its terms. It's actually not so. The statute speaks of individuals in removal proceedings. That would include those who are deportable and those who are excludable. So by its terms, it doesn't disqualify Dimitri. And so the plain language of the statute itself is a place where the government is incorrect as well. Second of all, the government relied on one case, this court's decision.
That denial of admission, that's in the statute.
That's the title of the statute, certainly, Your Honor, but the...
Well, in the body also, there's a reference to denial of admission.
That's correct, but there's also later on the reference to removal proceedings, those who are in removal proceedings, legal permanent residents who are in removal proceedings, and that is what Dimitri was. He was a legal permanent resident in removal proceedings. And keep in mind, Your Honor, that even the government has interpreted for years 212H to apply to at least some level of deportable aliens. And so this idea that the language of the statute in and of itself would disqualify a deportable alien like Dimitri is simply inaccurate. Finally, Your Honors, the one.
I understand you. This 212H, maybe I'm misreading it, 212HB. So I'm looking at page 14 of the government's brief. In the case of an immigrant whose spouse, you know, or an alien lawfully admitted for permanent residence, says if it's established that the alien's denial of admission would result in extreme hardship.
That's correct, Your Honor, but if you proceed later in the statute, it indicates that those individuals who are disqualified from a waiver, which would include folks who are sentenced to an aggravated felony or folks who have not spent 7 years in the United States, and it says individuals who have not spent 7 years immediately preceding the date of initiations of proceedings to remove the alien from the United States, and removal proceedings by their nature would include deportation proceedings. And of course, combine that with the fact that the government for years has applied 212H to a certain group of deportable aliens as well, certainly undercuts the argument of the government that the language doesn't apply here. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Hurt and Ms. Sabla. And court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow.